Before we begin, again, we will be having the annual audit of the church finances January 23rd of 2010 at 3 p.m. at Bill's. So if you are interested in volunteering to participate in that, we need one church member. And Bill says he has a sign-up sheet for the setup schedule for 2010. So if you are interested in applying in that area, get with him. And make your will known there. And thirdly, we have a need for someone to engage in review with the children in second session, which would be every other week on a Sunday. You would be provided information, crafts, these sorts of things that they can largely do. But the goal would be to sort of reinforce the prep school lesson that they had just had in the first session. So if you're interested in applying in any of those areas, let me or Bill know, I guess, and we'll see Bill on the sign-up sheet. I don't know anything about that. So, and you really need to see Bill on the audit thing, too, because I'm not involved in that either. Okay, let's make sure you are in fellowship then and continue on here. We're in verse 3. Now returning to the destruction of Nineveh and the, in fact, the look of the army, the way they appear in this vision that Nineveh had, that Nahum had seen, and not only their appearance, but the way in which they are going to function as they come to attack the city. So verse 3 moves right into the preparation, the immediate look before the battle. The shields of his mighty men are, they've supplied the word colored, which is fine, are red. The warriors are dressed in scarlet. The word magen is shield, M-A-G-E-N. That's the masculine singular noun construct, shields of, and then you got the masculine plural noun construct with the third masculine singular suffix of gibor. G-I-B-B-O-R. The mighty men, or strong men, these are the heroes of the armed forces. The third masculine singular suffix in this context has to reach back to verse 1 and refers to the scatterer. So throughout this destruction of Nineveh, one of the things you will see is that God talks about his part in this, and then there's the human part in this that goes along with it. They are not unique. They are each one cooperates with the other. The Scythians, the Medes, and the Babylonians were all too ready to destroy the Assyrians, as many nations on the planet were at that time. But even more importantly, the warrior king, the Lord of the armies, is ready to destroy them. And so that is the real issue here when the Lord of the armies comes against you. He commands all armies, not just the heavenly armies of the angelic conflict of the elect angels. He commands earthly armies as well in the destruction of nations. So the shields of his mighty men, again, the heroes of the military, pu'al participle, have been colored red, literally. Adam is actually the word. This is both the color red, proper name of the first man, Adam, again suggesting that he had a reddish appearance. As God created him from the dust of the earth. So the pu'al participle, again, the pu'al is intensive. Here, having been dyed red is the idea of it. Having been dyed completely red. And one of the reasons they did this, of course, the red shields, it is a symbol of the fact that they are going to spill the blood of their enemies. The red symbolizes the blood. And no doubt if they had used these shields in previous battles, they were still splattered with the blood of their enemies. But this would, again, to be colored red or dyed red. The warriors are dressed in scarlet. Warriors is a translation of a construct chain, the masculine plural noun construct of ish, I-Y-S-H. That means men of, literally. And again, individuals are more in view with the word ish. So the men of, and then you've got this word, Kail, C-H-I-Y-I-L. The word means might, strength, or power. The phrase is used 9 times and means able men or capable men. good soldiers. And so here, these particular men are singled out of the military, the mighty men and the warriors. I mean, you've got an entire group of soldiers, obviously, but certain soldiers distinguish themselves in the course of battle and in their conduct. All soldiers aren't created equal, we might say. The chariots are enveloped in flashing steel. The chariots, well, actually, it leads off here with the pu'al participle. Oh, I'm sorry, I've skipped one here. You've got another pu'al participle of tala, T-A-L-A apostrophe, and that means to be colored or dyed scarlet, or clad in scarlet clothing. Pardon me. So the warriors are dressed in scarlet. The chariots are enveloped in flashing steel. What you have is the Hebrew word order leads off with fire, literally. Inseparable preposition bait plus the word esh, E-S-H. Literally with fire. And then you've got the feminine plural noun of palada. P-E-L-A-D-H-A-H. And that word means iron or steel. Barzel is the normal word for iron, so probably steel. It's an element, and it's only used one time here, so it's very difficult to get a read on this word. But it's some metal in which, of course, they would cover their vehicles with in order to protect them in battle. And then you've got the definite article plus the common singular noun. And one of the things we will see consistently through here in the book of Nahum, Rekev, R-E-K-H-E-B-H, is that you have collective singulars used all through here. It's the chariot. But it's not referring to a specific chariot. It's referring to a category. It's referring to all the chariots that are there. So with flame of steel is the idea. They've translated that word flame by flashing, because as a fire kind of leaps and crackles and you get these flashes of light. The idea here is that light was reflecting off of whatever metal they had covered their chariots with. So the chariots are enveloped in flashing steel. That's fine. That's about as good as you can do with it here, I think. When he is prepared to march, you actually have a chain here, the inseparable preposition bait plus the word yom, in a day, literally. It doesn't have the definite article. In a day is a Hebrew idiom for, we would just translate it by when, at which time or whatever, something along that line. Then you've got the hifil infinitive construct with the third masculine singular suffix of kun, K-U-N, which means literally to plan ahead, to make provision for something, to prepare something. So the hifil infinitive construct is in his preparation, in the day of him to prepare would be a literal translation, but that's not, it's kind of wordy and doesn't communicate much. And so the New American Standard has done it good justice, I think, when he is prepared and they've supplied to march or for the battle, whatever you want to supply there. The idea here is that, and again, the third masculine singular suffix has to refer back to the scatterer, the one who's come against them, and has to reference God. And one of the reasons it's intriguing, history tends to suggest that there wasn't, because this was a coalition, that there wasn't one main leader of the entire organization. That there tended to be generals for each army, and because it was a true coalition, that they didn't have a, quote, commander-in-chief. Well, they do, but who's overseeing this, but that commander-in-chief is God. So when he is prepared to wage war was probably what I would supply, because given the fact that God is doing it. And the cypress spears are brandished. And then you have a wow plus the definite article plus this word, barosh, B-E-R-O-S-H. Now that means the evergreen tree, the pine, or the juniper. And it looks at sort of, obviously it's looking at a wood product. When the sticks are caused to quiver is what you really have in the Hebrew. The hafal perfect of ra'al. R-A apostrophe A-L. This word means to reel or to quiver. The hafal is the passive causative when they are caused to quiver. And the idea here is that with the army standing there prepared for battle, they are going to brandish their spears. There may even be some quivering because of nerves. We're not really told. Certainly before a major battle like this, soldiers are going to be on edge. But brandished, I think, kind of gives the idea of what's going on here as the military is lined up, ready to go. Then he leaps ahead at some level. He skips over here the initial charge and moves to once these people have started their charge, in fact, once it's well underway, and they are either approaching the city or in the city. And it may leap ahead to when they are in the city. Now, we will get a more full description. If you look ahead into chapter 3, you get a more full description of the battle from its inception in verse 2, starting with the crack of the whip, and the whip, of course, being used to urge the horses forward of the chariots, and the noise of the rattling of the wheel. And he paints a very great word picture here in which you hear the whip crack, you hear the chariots start to creak as the wheels begin to turn, and as they begin to pick up speed, and then they pick up speed, the galloping horses and bounding chariots, as the chariots are now approaching full speed and rushing wildly towards the city. And it's sort of what we might call in warfare organized chaos. They have a battle plan. Horsemen charging, spears flashing, swords flashing, spears gleaming, many slain, a mass of corpses, countless dead bodies. They stumble over the dead bodies. And so the carnage is addressed more here, as we will see, whereas sort of the events are discussed in our two verses. So the chariots race madly in the streets. You've got the inseparable preposition bait here, plus the definite article, plus coots. Coots means that which is on the outside. The word is very often just used of streets. And so as you approach the city, you are going to have these roads that led to Nineveh. Certainly that would be the first fulfillment of this as they race wildly down those roads as they're heading towards the city. The squares looks more, the second one looks more to me to be inside the city, although you can't, I don't know that you could definitely, definitively prove it without any question. At any rate, we have this is occurring both inside, and then of course once they get in the city, or outside the city initially on the approach, and then as they get into the city. So, in the streets, and then you've got the hiphpolel, perfect, the polel is just an alternate stem. It's the same, essentially, in meaning as the hiphael of Kalael, C-H-A-L-A-L. The word means literally to be insane. It stresses the irrational aspects of insanity. In fact, this was used, Solomon used this repeatedly in Ecclesiastes, that he wanted to explore. And I'm sorry, it's Hallel. There's no C there. That should be just a H-A-L-A-L. It's not Kalel, it's Hallel. He used this a lot when he said he wanted to explore wisdom and insanity. And so he looked into the insane aspects of the human condition. Here in this context, and it is used in other military contexts, not just here, it describes the wild, furious action of war chariots charging forward to attack the enemy. For instance, Jeremiah 46:9 is, I think, one of those places it's used. And again, in a military context, so you can kind of see what is the idea here. Go up, you horses, and drive madly, you chariots. Again, driving madly, we're not talking about, you know, literal insanity. We're talking about rushed and wild action. So they've translated here madly, which is fine. That communicates. The chariots race madly. And then you got, again, the collective singular, the definite article, plus the masculine singular noun of rekev, chariots. They rush wildly in the squares. Hithpalpel, again, very much like the hithpael. And the hithpael is the reflexive stem, typically. It can be used in other ways. But typically it's reflexive, i.e. that means they both perform the action and participate in it. So they are performers and participators at the same time. That's the idea behind the hiphael. We see it in words like, I took a shower. Well, you performed the action of taking a shower, but you washed yourself. That's the idea. Again, we'll see it very often in our reflexive pronouns. Toward one another or to yourself, to do something to or for yourself. So you have the hithpalpel, again, just the same as the hithpile, just a different root word, shakak, S-H-A-Q-A-Q. That word means to run around, to rush at someone. The hithpael denotes intense or energetic action in this regard. So that's why they've added the word really means to rush. They've added the word wildly as sort of a translation to reflect the hithpael, or the hithpalpel here. But and that's fine. That really does good justice to it, I think. So in the squares, or in the broad places, is an inseparable preposition bait, plus the definite article, plus the masculine plural noun of recove. R-E-C-H-O-B-H. That word means a broad place, an open expanse. It's very often used of town squares or also of marketplaces, the agora, where people would go, again, to engage in commerce. There was plenty of room there. Their appearance is like torches. They dash to and fro like lightning flashes. Their appearance is the masculine plural noun construct here, plus the third feminine plural suffix. The question becomes here is why the feminine plural suffix? There is because the word chariots is a singular, as we have seen. The shields is a singular. The strong men, the mighty men, are masculine. Well, they're all masculine. I'm sorry, I said singular. I mean masculine. All these things in here are masculine. The only feminine I found in near context goes back to that feminine plural noun of iron or steel in verse 3. The chariots are enveloped in flashing steel. And that may very well be what it's referring to, because what he talks about is like the dancing of light as it reflects off of things as they see these things happening and these machines are coming at you covered in metal. So their appearance, and that's Ma'are, apostrophe E-H, that comes from the verb ra'ah, to see, and it means what is seen, what one is looking at, hence the appearance. The appearance is like, inseparable preposition kaf here sets up a simile for us, it is like the torches. Definite article plus the masculine plural noun of lapid. L-A-P-P-I-Y-D-H. 13 times, it's used most often of flames or torches. Sometimes the word's even used of lightning. And like lightning, what is seen is like torches and like lightning, it says here. Like torches and like lightning, and that word is, again, a kaf here, inseparable preposition, plus barak. B-A-R-A-A-Q. That word means lightning, glittering, or flashing brightly. And then the polel perfect, again, the same as the PL, just a different root structure. And that's why they translate this different, of roots. And that word means, again, to run, to dart about. And so the only thing I could see is that the lights flashing, either the sunlight or the flames of torches as they are running towards the place, or they are setting fires. We don't really know for sure what all they're. It wouldn't appear that they are setting fires on the initial approach. That would, I would assume, occur later on during the attack. So again, this army comes at you, and it's sort of blinding. Because you see this light reflecting off of these chariots, and it's quite impressive. Well, point one, after dealing with the restoration of the fortunes of the unified kingdom of Israel, Nahum now provides the first of two descriptions dealing with the actual destruction of Nineveh. The first description is divided into two parts. The first deals with the description of those that will attack Nineveh. We see that in verses 3 through 6, and even up until... At some level, the final destruction is included in that, while the second deals with the results of the attack. We see as they rush madly, they stumble in their march, they hurry to the wall, the mantlet is set up in verse 5, the gates of the rivers are opened, the palace is dissolved. That deals with the initial attack and destruction. Then the results, it is fixed. She is stripped, she is carried away. Her handmaids are moaning like the sound of doves beating on their breaths. And you kind of get the aftermath and scene in verses 7 through 10. Now we're going to get again, as I pointed out in chapter 3, you're going to get another description of the initial attack in verses 2 through 3. And then you get, again, well, I haven't finished all of chapter 3, but it basically deals from now on out with Nineveh and all the things that are coming against it. So three, the first account of the attack moves from the description of the army preparing for the conflict. That's verse 3 as it sort of describes them standing there at attention, getting ready to go. And in many of these, of course, in ancient, and you see any of these movies like The Lord of the Rings or some of these things, you see these battle scenes in which they are mustering for the battle. And they're not really fighting yet, but they're just getting everything in place and they're getting ready to attack. So you see the initial attack as they approach the city walls in verse 4. In verse 5, you see the attack upon the walls. And I think I did limit this in verse 4 to outside the city based on what I saw in verse 5, where they hurry up to the wall, that they aren't quite there yet. So I did limit this in verse 4 to outside the attack. You see the breach of the river gates in verse 6. The capture of the palace and the taking of the harem in verse 7, and the pillaging of the city in verses 8 and 9, or actually through verse 10. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold, for there is no limit to the treasure. Wealth from every kind of desirable object. She is emptied, yes, she is desolate and waste. And so the city, the once great city, the proud city of Nineveh, which deemed itself to be invincible, as we find out, was not so invincible after all. But again, if God's against you, it doesn't matter who's for you. And if he's for you, it doesn't matter who's against you. So I like to try to stay in God's good graces. And I get jammed from time to time. You know, like I said a couple of weeks ago, I got jammed for being mean to my wife. And sometimes I get jammed for my own stupidity. That's not good. It doesn't feel any better when I'm being jammed for my own stupidity than when I'm under discipline, however. Except the only difference is, at least I know I only have myself to blame in both instances. So there isn't much of a difference. Like last week, I did some work and on Saturday, and I don't normally do a lot of studying on Saturday, but this day I felt motivated. So I went in and did a lot of work and study, and then I went to work and did some more on Monday because I had some extra time. And I copied the file on Monday, which didn't include my work from Saturday, however, and sent it to myself and overwrote 4 hours worth of work in about 2 seconds. And it was hard to get back in fellowship when I saw what I did. But I thought to myself, well, you're an idiot. You did it yourself. So who do you have to blame? And but I was a little mad at God. Because I said, you could have stopped this. You could have stopped me from this stupidity. Well, he didn't. And so ultimately, I knew it was my own fault, but I got angry. I got out of fellowship real mad. I wasn't just angry. I was furious. 4 hours of work down the drain just from that stupid move. So I said to myself, okay, I either got to get back in fellowship. So I got up and walked around for a while and thought about it and finally decided, well, I may as well rebound and get back there. This ain't going to redo itself. I looked everywhere thinking, hopefully I backed it up. So I have now hopefully created a fail-safe system to protect me from my own stupidity. So again, whether God's jamming you or whether you are getting into trouble from your own stupidity, in some ways it doesn't feel very good either way. So Nineveh may have thought they were invincible, but God can get through to you. God can get through to them. He can get through to anybody. So four, as Patterson has observed, there are several distinctive literary features in this chapter, which include simile. Of course, that is a comparison of two dissimilar things using the like or as, you know, in which they are compared. You have metaphor, again, in which a term or a phrase is applied to something what it's not literally applicable to, But there's some kind of resemblance, you know, like we sing that song, a mighty fortress is our God. Well, obviously God's not a fort, but he's got characteristics that make him like a fort. He is a refuge in time of need. And so then you have synecdoche, which is essentially where you use either the whole for the part or the part for the whole. For instance, when you see the chariot, he's talking about the entire mass of chariots. Or sometimes they'll use just a part of something. His eye will not pity. Well, the eye doesn't, it doesn't just mean his eye. I mean, it's the whole person. And so you have that used in here. Chiasmus, as I showed you, is a literary device in which you arrange things literarily in the form of a key, the Greek letter. And then paronomosia, of course, which is a word play in which words which sound alike or have a similar structure are used intentionally. And Nahum is good at all of these things. But five, although there are a number of literary features that are seen in this book, and chapter 2 is no exception, they add very little to the doctrinal understanding of the work. For technical study, maybe they're okay, but as far as teaching in a Bible class, these things don't help you. I mean, if I stop and point out every time he uses synecdoche, or similes are pretty easy because in the Hebrew you have that that inseparable preposition, kaf, which introduces them most of the time. So those are easy enough. And I have pointed out, I know in the notes, a couple of times where he uses, he has constructions that are intentionally made to be that way. But how do they help you in your Christian way of life for me to stop and deal with every one of those? They don't. They don't help at all. So while it's good to note these things, and again, the people, I have to give Patterson a plus in that he at least stopped and dealt with the very technical issues found within this book. Now, I don't know how good he would be at teaching it to a church. That's a whole different ballgame. Well, again, these things add, while they're there and they're true, they add little to the doctrinal understanding of the book. Six, the third person masculine suffix attached to the noun gabor. Mighty men, heroes, or champions of the military. Contextually refers back to the one who scatters in verse 1 and refers to God himself. And seven, in this case, God's mighty men consist of the combined forces of the Babylonians and Scythians and Medes. We know that there was a threefold group that attacked and took Nineveh during that time. Now, this one is a plural, though, so again, his mighty men is plural. Eight, the first item Nahum describes is the defensive armor of the opposing enemy, which is pictured by the pu'al participle of the verb adam, which means to be red and refers to that which has been dyed red. Exodus 26:14. And again, they may have intentionally dyed their shields red, and no doubt that went on, but certainly their shields may have been splattered with the blood of previous enemies. Because hand-to-hand combat at this time in history was pretty brutal stuff. I mean, it still is, but I mean, it was pretty brutal there. Exodus 26:14. And you shall make a covering for the tent of ram skins dyed red, and a covering of porpoise skins above. That gets into the construction of the tabernacle. So nine, Calvin has suggested that ancient warriors dyed their bull's hide shields red in order to strike terror into the enemy. However, G.V. Smith conjectures that the reference is to the red reflection of the sun's rays from the shields of bronze or copper, since these shields are found among Assyrian nations. I would opt for Calvin's explanation here, in my opinion, simply because of the nature of the verb. The pu'al participle indicates an outside agent having been made red. And so I would take them that the shields themselves are red, rather than just simply reflecting the sun's rays. Ten, as part of the psychological aspects of warfare, Xenophon records the fact that Persian soldiers wore clothing that was dyed red and purple. That's out of the document, The Instruction of Cyrus, Cyropadia. There appears to be some reason for this. Again, Why wear red clothing? It's to strike fear into the hearts of the enemies. Say, I've been in battle 100 times and it's stained with the blood of my enemies. And you are going to be no exception. And so it's a mental game, or a part of the mental aspects of warfare. 11 others have suggested that it refers to the shields of the uniforms being stained red with the blood of the Ninevites. However, the timing and placement of this verse describes the army before the conflict. So again, I think if purple always is, throughout history, has symbolized royalty. It's what royalty has worn. And so it's designed to sort of suggest, at a psychological level, the superiority of the advancing army coming towards you. Isaiah 63:2. So since the battle hasn't occurred yet, I do not place this as the blood of the Ninevites. That I reject, because the battle hasn't started at this time in our verse. Isaiah 63:2. This is a reference to Jesus Christ. Who is this who comes from Edom? And it appears that at the second advent that Jesus Christ goes to Edom first. Now, there's some question as to whether or not he doesn't step down on the Mount of Olives based on that verse in Acts, that where he will come just as he went in his ascension. So I haven't fully worked all the details to that one out yet, but again, that's a pretty small deal in the second advent, is to actually where he comes first. But certainly one of the things we do know, even if he does sit down on the Mount of Olives first, he makes a beeline apparently to Edom. And why Edom? Because that's where his people are holed up in Petra. And so he goes immediately there because the armies are upon them, and essentially they are out of hope. The end is in their sight and they know it. They have no hope left. And so he goes there first to deliver his people and begins the slaughter. Who is this who comes from Edom with garments of glowing colors from Bozrah? The one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads in the winepress? I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood was sprinkled on my garments. I stained all my raiment, for the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. And so, again, at the end of the Advent, the second Advent, and the destruction of the nations, God, Jesus, could simply just speak these people dead, but he doesn't. I mean, this is personal. He goes out and single-handedly slaughters these people, the likes of which is just going to be mind-boggling, to see the death and destruction in his wake. As he unsheathes his sword, no one will survive. And, of course, he's immortal, so that makes fighting a lot easier. Hey, I shot him with an arrow. He didn't die. Nah, yeah, you can't kill a resurrection body. That's a bit of a problem. Even if they get close enough to him, who knows if he'll even let him, it won't make any difference. And my guess is he's not waiting through there, you know, humming or whistling. I imagine he has got a look of fury on his face, the likes of which these people have never seen. And the destruction, the slaughter is just going to be, I mean, just incredible. So again, people could get their garments stained with warfare, but again, I think this is intentional. I think they've been dyed red or scarlet because this is, they're trying to send a signal. And again, you've got that pu'al participle, which it would indicate an outside agent having been turned red or dyed red. So 12, the verb tala is the presumed root of the noun that was used to describe the brilliant scarlet or crimson dye that was obtained from the female bodies of the Kermes worm. It's used in Isaiah 1:18, for instance. So this is where they get this color. You derive various colors, as they did. They didn't synthesize colors. They didn't have a Crayola factory. So they synthesized colors from natural agents within the world. But they weren't artificial colors, we might say. Isaiah 1:18, come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are as scarlet, blood red, we might say, they will be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they will be white like wool. And the white word white's not in there, but supply it for the understanding. And you can also see Lamentations 4:5. But this was how they got the scarlet color, and the worm was crushed, and it yielded this brilliant red. The phrase here, Anshe Kail, is used 9 times in the Old Testament, and denotes that men that are able, men that are capable of doing whatever is in view. For instance, Genesis 47:6, it's not always used in a military context. It just means someone who is adept at what they do. Well, in a military context, you're talking about really, really good, strong, well-trained soldiers. Genesis 47:6, the land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the... This is Pharaoh speaking to Joseph now, as he realizes Joseph's family has come to him. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land, and let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know any capable men among them, put them in charge of my livestock. And so, again, here, capable men in this context would be well-trained shepherds. Also, Exodus 18:21. And this, again, ironically enough, this action of Pharaoh here formed the beginning of the rejection and the hostility that existed towards Israel that finally came to a head under the Pharaoh who did not know Joseph, as they began to persecute them. Why? Because the Jews were exalted and given the best of the land of Egypt. Well, if you were an Egyptian, how would you feel about that? Hey, I've lived here all my life. Pharaoh never gave me a damn thing. And now these foreigners come in here? Well, Joseph had single-handedly saved the entire Egyptian economy. And in fact, the Egyptian populace. So this was not, it wasn't just as though, like our borders today, where we just let anybody in who wants to do anything they want to do. Joseph was a national hero and should have been. So this wasn't Pharaoh just, you know, arbitrarily laying over, rolling over for Joseph. Now this was necessitated by the nature of the events. Exodus 18:21. This is here where Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, comes and gives him advice. Because Moses doesn't know how to delegate at this point. And so he's hearing literally every little complaint. In the law courts. Somebody stole my pet hamster. Well, Moses doesn't need to concern himself with that. And so he would sit there and literally sit from morning until evening just judging cases between people. And Jethro comes and offers him good advice. He says in verse 18, "You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you. For the task is too heavy for you. You can't do it alone. So now listen to me, and I give you some advice, counsel. And God be with you." Hey, you let God sort this out. Maybe this is good advice. I think it is. But, Jethro was apparently humble and didn't try to force his way onto Moses. He just said, and he maintained, intriguingly enough, he maintained good relations with Moses in spite of the fact that Jethro's daughter had dumped Moses and run off. Intriguing. So you never know how things can work out. But Jethro maintained, apparently, some allegiance to Moses during all of this. So furthermore, verse 20, "You shall select out of the people able men." And here, able men are now judges who fear God, men of truth, those who hate dishonest gain. "And you shall place them as leaders over thousands, over hundreds, over fifties, and of tens." And clearly you would select somebody who is most capable to do the thousands. And then lesser capable men. But still, at the end of the day, you wanted men who wanted to ensure justice was done. And that. So there, in this context, capable men would be good judges. In our context, capable men are strong soldiers. So 14, in this context, as well as other military contexts, it refers to the most capable soldiers. Therefore, it is often translated as valiant warriors, as it is in Judges 20. And of course, Judges is a good book for reading up on warfare, because there was a lot of warfare going on during that book. Also, in the book of Joshua, there was a lot of warfare going on. Judges 20:44. "Thus 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. All these were valiant warriors." And verse 46, "So all of Benjamin who fell that day were 25,000 men who draw the sword." All these were valiant warriors. These weren't just your average, everyday, run-of-the-mill G.I. Joe. These were men who were skilled. who were good fighters. But see, Benjamin was under judgment in this case, and the sons of Israel had come against them in a civil war because of things that were going on in the tribe of Benjamin. Some pretty gross stuff, in fact. So 15, the next item that Nahum turns to are the chariots of the invading armies. Although the term rekav, chariot, is found in the singular and coupled with the definite article, it is to be understood as a collective singular and translated chariots. And they've done this throughout here because the word term shields is a singular. Mighty men is at least a plural. You got men of... The men are always referred to here, it seems to here, as far as I can remember, as plurals, while the elements that they fight with or the defensive capabilities are all singulars, but they're collective singulars. So 16, this is seen in other places in the Old Testament where the singular term chariot most often is used to refer to the entire group of chariots. However, the plural of the verb that follows indicates multiple chariots are in view. So when you have this, their chariots... are enveloped, you got a pu-all participle, masculine, plural. Oh, I'm sorry, I'll take that back. You've got the feminine plural noun, steels. The plural verb went with the singular, or the plural men of strength. So Exodus 14:7 is the verse. Multiple chariots are in view. Again, this is not an unusual literary device to speak of a singular when you're, to use a singular when you're referring to plurals. Then he took 600 select chariots. And that word there in the English or in the Hebrew is a singular, chariot. 600 chariot. But we wouldn't, for good translation, we wouldn't do that. And you can also see Joshua 11:4. 17, although the term palada, that's our term, the difficult term for iron or steel, is used in only one time, and it's here, used only once in the Old Testament, making it difficult to link to a verbal root, the consensus is that the term probably refers to metal or steel. And 18, this is consistent with what we find in history as Xenophon, who writes some, you know, a couple hundred years later, describes the armies of Cyrus the Persian, and they armed their horses with frontlets and breastplates. The saddle horses also they armed with thigh pieces, and the chariot teams with side armor. So the whole army flashed with bronze and was resplendent in purple. Again, out of the document Cyropadia. 19, this might refer either to the metallic pole attachments for the chariot spears, the side armor of the chariots, or the steel scythes attached to the axle of a chariot. And if you've seen, you've probably seen in movies, this was not unknown, that when they rode in chariots, they would have these metal protuberances on the side, sharp metal protuberances, so as the chariot went by, if it struck anybody, it would slice them to bits. Or certainly if it came by and was close enough to a horse, it would easily cut the tendons and the legs. So this was, again, not unknown or unusual, so I don't see anything here that stands out other than that the word itself is unique to this particular context. So 20, in any case, they are said to exist with fire, which was does not refer to literal fire in this case, but to the fact that the horses, men, and chariots were outfitted with highly polished metal that flashed like fire in the bright sunlight. And 21, one question that has arisen is whether or not this is continuing the description of the army as it prepares for battle, or if this describes the initial onslaught. And 22, the answer would seem to be found in what follows, which is described in the Hebrew as the day of his preparation, when he is prepared to march, which would picture the chariots assembling for the open opening charge of the battle. Proverbs 21:31. So I still take this verse, of course, that they can see all this. Nahum sees all this in his vision, but they haven't really begun yet. But as they begin to move, this flashing is going to become more regular and more repeated as the sun, as these chariots bounce around through, badly rutted roads or across the countryside. It's not like they had asphalt. It wasn't going to be a smooth ride into the city. And then, of course, you're going to get even more and more as the dead begin to mount, as the initial wave of chariots comes up against the outskirts of Nineveh. And the slaughter begins. Proverbs 21:31, the horse is prepared for the day of battle. And it uses that same term there, prepared or preparation. But the victory belongs to the Lord. And so it kind of looks at the beginning stage, the preparation for the battle, and then the final outcome. 23, the hiphil infinitive construct of the verb kun means to cause something to be ready, to prepare it. As such, it is used of gathering and preparing weapons and equipment for the day of battle. 2 Chronicles 26:14. And here Uzziah preparing for battle. Moreover, Uzziah prepared for all the army. Shields, spears, helmets, body armor, bows, and sling stones. And in Jerusalem he made engines of war, invented by skillful men to be on the towers and on the corners for the purpose of shooting arrows and great stones. They appear to be catapults of some sort that he's come up with here in order to defend his city. Hence his fame spread afar, for he was marvelously helped until he was strong. And then, of course, Uzziah gets arrogant. Meet with success, God blesses you, and that's the danger. The danger is, again, many people can stand the day of adversity. How many people can stand the day of prosperity? That's what gets people into trouble many times. And so Uzziah fell into that same thing. He was fine, God was blessing him, as long as he remained humble. But verse 16, but when he became strong, his heart was proud, so that he began to act corruptly. And also Psalm 7:12. Here dealing with people, God is a righteous judge, verse 11, a God who has indignation every day. If a man does not repent, if he doesn't change his mind, he will sharpen his sword. He has bent his bow and made it ready. He has also prepared for himself deadly weapons. He makes arrows, fiery shafts. And the idea, of course, is that when people do not remain humble and choose to take on God, they've made a huge mistake, because God has all things at his disposal. Again, language of accommodation for God disciplining or judging the believer, or even in maybe the negative unbeliever in this case, because he's dealing with the wicked in verse 9. So 24, as the sentries and maybe the inhabitants of Nineveh looked outside the walls, they would have seen the flashes of light that were reflecting from the metal that was so abundant on the assembled armies. And 25, likening the sight to fire would indicate that judgment was at hand, since fire is a regular method of referring to judgment in the Old Testament. God often used fire. He would use literal fire sometimes, as for instance in Genesis here, 19:24. Getting into the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And again, he used the natural elements there that existed within the Jordan Valley, which at that time was quite lush and green. And it appears that Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain, those five cities, were located on the southern edge of what is now the Dead Sea. And how did the Dead Sea become the Dead Sea? Why is it so tremendously salty? Well, the appearance it appears that as it washed over, as the waters came over this area, that what was left of this place sort of had this adverse impact on the ecology. So also Joshua 6:24. So sometimes he will talk about judgment in terms of fire. Sometimes it's literal fire. Depending upon what he wants to use. But again, as these things flash like fire, the indication of it is that there's some danger. that this is something to be fearful of. 24, they burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. Okay, well, our time is gone, so we will stop there and continue on with this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for this time together. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.